the human brain. It's like a whole universe inside our heads, isn't it?
Absolutely.
It's where everything happens, thoughts, feelings, actions.
Mm-hmm.
And we're just, well, naturally fascinated by trying to figure out how it all works.
It's an endless quest.
Yeah. You sent us this really great collection of information. And today, we want to unpack the key bits, give you a clear picture of how we actually know what we know about the brain.
Focusing on that functional structure, the methods we use.
Exactly. So our mission today is to pull out those main techniques we use to investigate this amazing organ, understand its basic organization, and highlight some of the incredible insights we've gained. Maybe even peek at where things are heading.
Sounds good. And it's quite a journey when you look back. I mean, even in ancient times, people noticed links between brain injury and, you know, behavioral changes.
Really? How far back?
Well, there's Egyptian papyrus, maybe 5,000 years old. It documents paralysis linked to brain damage.
Wow.
And later, Hippocrates in Greece, he saw that damage on one side of the brain could cause problems on the opposite side of the body.
Okay, so they were noticing things.
They were. But what's fascinating is, despite this, both the Egyptians and the Greeks, they thought the heart was the center of it all. Mental functions, everything.
The heart. So the brain wasn't the star yet.
Not for a long time. It really took a while for that understanding to shift.
Okay, so the heart had its moment, but like fast forward a few thousand years,
yeah,
we start seeing more direct ways of looking at the brain.
Yeah, exactly. And this is where it starts getting really interesting experimentally. Late 19th century, you have researchers like Hitzing and Frisch.
Mm.
They started using electrical stimulation on animal brains. A much more direct way to link specific brain areas to behavior.
Right. Stimulating bits to see what happens.
Precisely. Then, mid-20th century, neurosurgery comes onto the scene. Initially, things like the prefrontal lobotomy, Antonio Muniz pioneered that.
Lobotomy?
Yeah.
That sounds pretty intense. He got a Nobel Prize for that.
He did, yes, in 1949. The idea was to sever connections, thalamus, hypothalamus, frontal lobes to treat psychiatric issues. It was, you know, an early attempt to directly change brain function to fix mental illness.
Drastic, though. What were the results?
Well, yeah, drastic is a good word. It was initially seen as this breakthrough, but later it became clear it often had really severe side effects, personality changes, cognitive problems.
Oh, wow.
It's a stark reminder, isn't it, how complex this all is, how careful we need to be.
Definitely.
But around the same time, the 1950s, you had surgeons like Wilder Penfield. He was doing epilepsy surgery.
Mm.
And while patients were conscious, he'd stimulate different parts of the exposed brain.
Whoa.
Yeah. And he could map out which areas related to specific sensations or movements. He created these detailed functional maps. Direct evidence linking brain spots to experiences.
So we're moving from these more invasive methods. How did we start looking inside without, you know, opening things up? The non-invasive stuff.
Exactly. That's been the real game changer. EEG, electroencephalography, that was one of the first big ones.
Right. The brainwave thing.
Yeah. People were trying to measure the brain's electricity back in the 19th century. But Adolf Beck at Jagiellonian University in the 1890s, he made real progress. Recorded signals he called active current independent.
Okay.
But it was Hans Berger, 1929, who did the first human EEG recordings. He noticed these oscillations around 10 hertz that were strongest. The key insight, the brain makes electricity we can measure from the scalp.
And those waves, those oscillations, they're different, right? Not all the same.
One at all, no. They're like signatures for different brain states. You've got delta waves, really slow, below 4 hertz deep sleep.
Okay.
Theta waves, 4 to 8 hertz, kind of all over the cortex. Ma rhythm, 8-12 hertz, linked to the motor cortex.
Oh.
SMR, sensorimotor rhythms, 13-15 hertz, often when you're resting, but alert.
Right.
Then beta, 13-30 hertz, that's more perception, attention, short-term memory. And gamma, above 30 hertz, linked to more complex stuff. Cognition, putting senses together.
So you can tell what the brain's generally up to by looking at these wave patterns.
Sort of, yeah. The raw EEG signal is messy. It's a mix of all these frequencies. But a technique called Fourier analysis lets us break it down and see how much power there is in each frequency band.
Okay, so EEG shows us the electrical buzz.
Mm-hmm.
What's it good for? What are the downsides?
Well, it's relatively cheap, easy to use, and its temporal resolution is fantastic. Milliseconds.
Super fast timing.
Exactly. So great for things where timing is key, like diagnosing epilepsy, sleep disorders. It's used in neurofeedback, brain-computer interfaces too.
Mm-hmm.
We can even average the EEG responses to specific events that gives us ERPs, event-related potentials. Signals like P200, P300 tell us about cognitive processing stages.
But the downside?
The spatial resolution. Pinpointing exactly where the activity is coming from, that's harder. It mostly reflects activity near the surface in the cortex.
Makes sense.
Now, you can get better spatial detail with intracranial EEG or ECOG. Electrodes right on the brain surface.
Ah, but that's invasive again.
Right. Highly invasive. Usually only for specific medical reasons, like planning epilepsy surgery. It's always this trade-off, you know? Timing versus location accuracy.
Got it. Okay, so what about MEG, magnetoencephalography? How's that different?
Similar idea to EEG, but instead of electricity, it measures the tiny magnetic fields produced by those same neural currents, mainly in the dendrites.
Magnetic fields
from
the brain. That must be incredibly weak.
Unbelievably weak. You need these ultra-sensitive detectors called SQUIDEDs, superconducting quantum interference devices.
Wow. Okay. So what's the advantage over EEG?
Well, magnetic fields aren't distorted as much by the skull and scalp as electrical fields are. So MEG can potentially see deeper sources more clearly than EEG, and it can pick up faster signals too, even above 100 hertz. Better spatial resolution than scalp EEG, basically.
Deeper and faster. Sounds great. What's the catch?
The main things are cost that SquadTech is expensive and the need for serious magnetic shielding. The brain's fields are minuscule compared to like the Earth's magnetic field or just background noise.
Right. You'd need a special room.
Exactly. And interpreting the signals like EEG is still complex. It's not a simple picture.
Okay. So we've got electrical and magnetic signals covered. Now let's shift gears. What about techniques that give us more of a picture of the brain structure or how it's working metabolically, like SETI scans, PET, MRI?
Right. These give us different kinds of views, often complementary. Arteriography or angiography that uses contrast dye and x-rays to look at blood vessels, crucial for strokes, aneurysms, things like that.
Vascular issues?
Precisely. Then SET scans, computed tomography, also use x-rays, often with contrast, to create cross-sectional images, slices of the brain structure.
Like a detailed x-ray?
Kind of. Great for bone, detecting bigger issues like tumors or bleeding, but distinguishing different soft tissues like gray versus white matter, not as good as MRI. Newer versions, HRCT, MSCT, offer better resolution, though. The key thing is it's a static structural picture using x-rays.
Okay, and what about methods that show function or specific chemicals?
That brings us to SPECT and PET. SPECT, single photon emission computed tomography, uses radioactive isotopes that give off gamma rays.
Radioactive isotopes.
Yeah, tracers. It lets us see blood flow and where specific substances go in the brain. It can detect compounds absorbed by certain structures, but its resolution, both spatial and temporal, isn't the best.
Mm-hmm.
There have been some controversial claims about using SPECT for psychiatric diagnosis, like from Daniel Eman, but those aren't really backed by solid research. It can be useful for looking at blood flow problems in neurological disorders, though.
Okay. And PET?
PET positron emission tomography is similar, but it detects positrons from radioactive tracers. Often, it uses glucose tagged with carbon-11, since active brain cells use more glucose.
You can see which areas are working harder.
Exactly. It images blood flow, glucose metabolism. It can also track specific molecules like dopamine receptors, so it's valuable for research on brain function during tasks, finding epilepsy hotspots, tumors. And it's very sensitive to tiny amounts of substances. It reveals metabolic activity in specific molecules.
Got it. PET shows metabolism. Now, MRI, magnetic resonance imaging. That one seems to pop up everywhere. Sounds really versatile.
It really is. Anatomical MRI gives us incredibly detailed pictures of brain structure. It uses strong magnetic fields and radio waves to look at hydrogen atoms, mostly in water molecules.
Hydrogen atoms.
Yeah. Different tissues have different water content and environments, so they respond differently. By tweaking the radio pulses, we get T1-weighted or T2-weighted images. They provide excellent contrast between gray matter, white matter, cerebrospinal fluid.
So you can really see the different parts clearly.
Totally. There's also FLIR imaging, a type of T2, which is great for looking at myelin, the insulation around fibers. MRI gives fantastic spatial resolution down to millimeters, detailed static anatomy.
And functional MRI, fMRI, how does that work?
So fMRI builds on that. It uses what's called the BOLD signal, blood oxygen level dependent.
BOLD.
It's basically an indirect measure of brain activity. When neurons fire up, they need more oxygen, so blood flow increases to that area. Oxygenated and deoxygenated blood have different magnetic properties.
And fMRI detects that difference.
Exactly. It lets us see which brain areas become more active during a task. Its spatial resolution is pretty good, like 1 to 5 millimeters usually, even better with stronger magnets. But its temporal resolution is slower seconds, not milliseconds, because blood flow changes are slower than neuron firing.
Right, it's measuring the consequence of the activity, not the activity itself.
Precisely. People use fMRI for things like BWSS, brain-wide association studies, trying to link brain activity patterns to cognitive skills or mental health conditions.
Yeah.
But you have to be careful analyzing fMRI data. Remember that dead salmon study?
The one where they found brain activity in a dead fish.
That's the one. It showed you can find spurious correlations if you don't apply the right statistical corrections. A very important cautionary tale. So fMRI indirectly maps activity via blood flow changes.
A vivid reminder indeed. Any other MRI-based methods we should know about?
Yeah, briefly. There's MRS magnetic resonance spectroscopy. That looks at brain chemistry, measuring concentrations of neurotransmitters, other metabolites.
So chemistry, not just structure or blood flow.
Right. And there are other specialized MRI techniques too. Then beyond MRI, you have things like hemoencephalography, uses infrared, mainly for biofeedback, tracking brain temperature changes linked to blood flow.
Infrared.
Yeah, and NRSOT, near-infrared spectroscopy. It shines near-infrared light through the skull and measures how much is absorbed by oxygenated versus deoxygenated blood. Decent timing, but lower spatial resolution, mostly sees the cortex near the surface.
Okay.
There's a simpler version, AAG, also for neurofeedback, and then some more experimental things like ITER, electrical impedance tomography, measuring current distribution, potentially very fast timing that's still developing. And photoacoustic methods like MSOT, using lasers and sound waves, but not really used for human brain imaging yet.
Wow, it really is quite a toolkit. So if you compare the main non-invasive ones, EEG, MEG, GET, fMRI, NIRS, what are the big trade-offs?
That's key, EEG and MEG. Great timing, milliseconds, but knowing exactly where, more limited, especially deep down.
Okay.
PET. Good spatial resolution lets you track specific chemicals, but slow timing and involves radioactivity,
right.
fMRI, a pretty good balance. Good spatial resolution gives functional info, but slower timing, and it's indirect, remember the bold D signal?
Indirect.
NRSOT. Cheaper, portable maybe, but lower spatial resolution, mostly surface activity.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the best tool really depends on what question you're asking, and often combining them give the richest picture.
Combining them. Like EEG and fMRI together.
Exactly. That's a big area of research trying to get the best of both worlds. High temporal resolution and good spatial localization.
Makes sense. What about the future? Are we going to get even better ways to see inside non-invasively?
I think so, yeah. Besides combining methods, people are working on making each technique faster, more precise, developing smarter ways to analyze all the incredibly complex data we get.
Uh-huh.
But combining techniques can be technically really hard. Think about putting sensitive EEG or MEG sensors inside a super powerful MRI magnet. It's tricky.
Yeah, I can imagine. Okay, so we've talked a lot about how we studied the brain. What are some of the big things we've actually learned about its structure and function from all this imaging?
Well, one interesting finding is about brain size and IQ. Overall size, only weakly correlated.
Really?
Yeah. But the amount of gray matter in specific cortical areas, frontal, temporal, parietal lobes, that shows a much stronger link to IQ scores.
So it's not just size, but specific structures.
Exactly. We've also seen some sex differences in white versus gray matter proportions and how they relate to IQ test results, though what those differences actually mean is still debated. And huge projects like the Human Connectome Project, HCP, they've been using advanced MRI to map out the brain's wiring diagram structurally and functionally. Massive data sets, often publicly available, really transforming how we see brain organization.
The connectome, the brain's wiring.
Yep. And techniques like BrainBow, using fluorescent colors in animal models to see individual neurons and trace their connections. That's giving us incredible microscopic detail, too. We're just getting much, much more detail about connections at all scales.
So we can observe the brain, map it. Can we also influence it directly? Brain stimulation.
Yes, absolutely. That's another major area. Techniques that let us actively modulate brain activity. TMS, transcranial magnetic stimulation, is a big one.
Magnetic pulses.
Yeah, non-invasively stimulating specific brain spots from outside the skull.
Yeah.
Different patterns like repetitive TMS, RTMS, or theta burst, TBS, can either excite or inhibit areas, and it's being used therapeutically.
For what?
Depression, hallucinations, and schizophrenia, even epilepsy.
Interesting. And there's electrical stimulation, too.
Right. TDCS, transcranial direct current stimulation, uses weak electrical currents, also non-invasive, It's cheaper than TMS, and it's being explored for a whole range of things: depression, PTSD, tinnitus, epilepsy, Parkinson's, migraines, chronic pain. Lots of potential applications.
So we can turn up or turn down specific brain areas.
Kind of, yeah. There are other methods too, like stimulating the vagus nerve or deep brain stimulation, which is invasive. But TMS and TDCS are key tools for non-invasively probing brain function and exploring treatments. We can excite or inhibit regions and see what happens.
Okay, so with all this tech imaging activity, mapping connections, even stimulating areas, are we at the point where we can use, say, an fMRI scan to diagnose psychiatric conditions like depression or schizophrenia?
That's the big question. We can see differences in fMRI studies, altered information flow in autism, depression, schizophrenia. We see patterns. But using it for routine clinical diagnosis in psychiatry, we're not quite there yet. The findings can be complex to interpret for an individual, variability is high, and cost is still an issue. Right now, neuroimaging in psychiatry is mostly a research tool to understand the underlying biology.
So observation isn't enough.
Exactly. To really get at the mechanisms, we need more than just pictures of brain activity. We need computational models.
Models? Like computer simulations?
Yeah, mathematical models that try to simulate and explain how brain processes work. Computational neuroscience. We're getting better at building models, especially for things like vision or language, that actually match up well with brain data. That's crucial for bridging the gap, going from seeing what the brain does to understanding why and how.
That makes sense. Which brings us to the brain's overall architecture, all these different parts. How do they work together? Could you give us a quick overview, maybe some examples of when things go wrong?
Sure. Broadly, you can think about the brain developmentally, forebrain, midbrain, hindbrain, or functionally, like the brain stem for basic survival functions.
Breathing, heartbeat.
Right. Then the limbic system, emotions, memory, and the neocortex, the wrinkly outer layer for higher level thinking, planning, language. Key structures manage specific jobs. Hypothalamus for homeostasis. Thalamus as a sensory relay, basal ganglia for movement and reward.
Okay.
Now think about conscious recognition. Say, seeing something. Info goes from your eyes through the thalamus to the primary visual cortex, basic shapes, colors, then to secondary areas where it gets meaning, oh, that's a cup, based on memory.
Right.
Normally, your emotional reaction, the affective part, gets integrated with this cognitive recognition. That's my favorite cup. But if the connections between these cognitive and emotional processing areas get disrupted, well, that's when you can get some really strange phenomena.
Like those delusional misidentification syndromes you mentioned.
Exactly. They're fascinating because they show what happens when integration breaks down. Take Capgras syndrome.
Okay, Capgras.
Someone with Capgras believes a familiar person, often a spouse, parent, child, has been replaced by an identical imposter.
An imposter, wow.
Yeah. They cognitively recognize the face. Yes, that looks exactly like my wife. But they lack the normal feeling of familiarity, the emotional warmth that should go with it.
So the emotional connection is just gone.
Seems to be, yeah. The theory is often damaged to pathways connecting face recognition areas with the limbic system, the emotional centers. And interestingly, it's not always just visual. There are cases involving smell, touch.
Mm-hmm.
Even recognizing a loved one's voice over the phone might be okay, while seeing them face to face triggers the delusion. It points to a disconnect between the sensory input and the expected emotional tag.
That's deeply unsettling. What are some of the other ones?
Well, there's intermetamorphosis, the belief that different people are psychologically swapping identities even though they look the same.
Okay.
Fregoli delusion is kind of the opposite of Capgras. The person believes different people are actually the same person in disguise. Maybe the emotional familiarity signal is too strong or misapplied, even if cognitively they look different. Delusion of doubles, believing you have one or more exact duplicates out there. Mirror misidentification, thinking your own reflection is someone else. And then Cotard syndrome, that's the belief that you are dead, don't exist, or perhaps that your internal organs are missing or putrefied.
Believing you're dead.
Yeah. It's also thought to involve a profound disconnect between self-awareness and emotional feeling. Maybe similar pathways to Capgras are involved. These are often monothematic delusions focused on one specific bizarre belief. And they can happen after things like encephalitis, temporal lobe damage, strokes. They really highlight how our sense of reality relies on different brain systems working together seamlessly.
It's crucial to distinguish these from, say, Hallucinations where the person knows it's not real.
Absolutely. That's the difference between a true delusion and something like parahallucinations and Charles Bonnet syndrome, visual hallucinations in people with vision loss, or Lermody's peduncular hallucinosis, vivid hallucinations, often with brainstem issues. In those, the person often retains insight they know it's not real. With delusions, the belief is fixed.
You mentioned the thalamus earlier as a relay station. How central is it to all this integration?
Oh, incredibly central. The thalamus deep in the brain, it's like the main switchboard. It gets sensory input from everywhere except smell, interestingly, and relays it to the cortex. But it's not just passive relay. No, it's involved in integrating sensory and motor information. It plays a huge role in attention, sleep cycles. It actively gates the flow of information through these corticothalamic loops. It's also considered part of the limbic system.
So it's filtering and directing traffic.
Pretty much. It has different nuclei, different parts, each connecting to specific cortical areas. Anterior nuclei linked to limbic areas for memory and arousal. Medial nuclei to the prefrontal cortex for emotion and cognition, ventral nuclei relay motor and sensory info. The pulvinar integrates different senses, and the reticular nucleus acts like a gatekeeper, an inhibitory layer controlling what gets through the other thalamic nuclei. This is critical for attention focusing on one thing and filtering out distractions.
And specific senses have their own relays.
Yes, the lateral geniculate nucleus, LGN, for vision, the medial geniculate body, MGB, for hearing. They process information before sending it to the visual and auditory cortex, so damage to the thalamus or its connections. That can cause all sorts of problems, sensory loss, movement disorders, attention deficits, memory issues, emotional changes, really underscores its vital role.
It's just mind-boggling how interconnected it all is.
Yeah.
And how specific breakdowns can lead to these really profound, sometimes bizarre, changes in experience.
It truly is. And it really shows that our motivations, our sense of self, our reality, it's not down to just one brain spot firing. It's the complex interplay, the network. We've made amazing progress with all these methods we've discussed.
Yeah.
But fully explaining consciousness, complex disorders, that ongoing quest relies on understanding this intricate dance between regions.
So let's try to wrap things up. We've taken this deep dive into how we study the brain structure function. What are the really key takeaways you'd want someone listening to remember?
I think the main things are, first, how far we've come from just observing injuries to having this incredible toolkit of neuroimaging and stimulation methods.
Right.
Second, understanding the strengths and weaknesses of these tools, EEGMEG for timing, MIF, MRI for structure and location, PE for chemistry. They each give us a different piece of the puzzle.
Uh-huh.
And third, how using these tools has shown us connections between specific brain functions or dysfunctions and particular circuits, like how those strange misidentification syndromes can actually point to breakdowns in how our brain integrates perception and emotion. Our understanding is built layer by layer using these diverse approaches.
Yeah, and yeah, those aha moments connecting a seemingly bizarre symptom to a specific circuit problem, they really hit home.
Exactly. But, you know, it's also crucial to remember how much we don't know. The brain is still incredibly mysterious, the field is vast, and the questions keep getting more complex as our tools get better.
So it leaves you thinking, considering this intricate dance of brain regions, and how easily almost our perceptions can shift. What does it really mean to experience reality? How much of what we perceive is just a construct of this amazingly complex, sometimes fragile organ?
That's the perfect question to ponder. It makes you reflect on your own subjective experience and the hidden neural machinery running underneath it all.
A lot to think about.
Indeed. And hopefully it sparks even more curiosity about the brain. The journey to understand it is definitely far from over.